Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have an old friend, someone I have a lot of respect for, Deepak Gupta. Deepak, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ashutosh. My pleasure.
Deepak is from St. Xavier's, Calcutta. He's an MBA from Case Western, CPA from USA, CA from India, worked for KPMG, PwC, Citibank, Korn Ferry, and now is doing his own little startup called Eden Retirement Living. Deepak, very nice to have you on the show. Do tell us about some of the early highlights of your professional life.
So I think I'll step into my final year of my MBA program, and I'm almost wanting to say that my professional life kind of started from there. So I was at Case Western Reserve, and foreigners were not allowed to interview on campus. And I realized that the only way you can get a job getting out of is from campus. And so you had to get on to the schedules of these companies coming. So I lodged a big war with the placement office and ultimately had a very big discussion with the director there and said to them, I said, look, at the end of the day, your role is nothing but facilitating, right? You're bringing a potential candidate in front of a potential employer. Mm. And beyond that, there's no role. So you can't stop me from doing this. Mm. I will give you my word of honor that I'll write to every company ahead of time, tell them that I'm a foreigner. And if they say no, then I won't sign up. But if they say it's okay, then I will sign up and you can't stop me. Mm. And that became like a turning point in the history of the university. Wow. Because I managed to do that. I got my first job with KPMG coming right out of campus. And post that, they changed the rules for all foreigners, you know, being allowed to interview. Yeah. So I think the learning from that was not to take a no and to question. And I think I maintained that throughout my career, which is what has helped me.
Fantastic.
So that was starting there. Then my first job was with KPMG right there in the US, in Cleveland. And I think one of the early highlights there was that they put the entire responsibility of a merger and acquisition that we were doing in the healthcare industry between two hospitals and asked me to develop a financial model. And in those days, there was no Excel.
Correct.
We had something called Lotus 1-2-3. Yeah. So I mastered Lotus 1-2-3 in putting together this really crazy, huge financial model of consolidating two hospitals, finding the duplicacies, removing them, and creating efficiencies and allowing the merger to happen. And it became such a good exercise that then we started using that model for all our M&A work at KPMG in the US, entire US.
Wow.
So that was one of my very, very early highlights, probably my first couple years of my career. So that was kind of fun.
Amazing. And then to PwC?
Then to PwC, continuing in consulting. And then got picked up by Citibank because all this time that I was doing management consulting, it was in the healthcare industry. So then Citibank picked me up as a healthcare expert, industry expert, coming into the healthcare lending division.
Okay.
So I worked there for 3-4 years, which was kind of fun. We did a lot of big financing deals, lending deals to large hospital chains and so forth, the Mayo Clinic, you know, lots of big multi-specialty clinics. And then I took a transfer to India, which is again a big question mark in the eyes of the bank, because they even flew me to New York from Dallas those days to really figure out what's wrong with this guy. I mean, 1992, nothing was happening in India, and why is this guy wanting to
Correct.
Go back to India?
Correct.
So they wanted to counsel me to tell me that, dude, are you aware that when you go to India, you're going to go on an Indian salary? That means a huge break from what you're making here, because our policy is that we would only give you an expat role if we ask you to go. So anyways, I made the move to India. And I think the next sort of highlight in my career was really being part of the Citibank team in India.
So what made you move back to India? You know, that was at a time when everyone went, when the brain drain was happening.
Yeah.
From India to that. And you're one of the few people I know who chose to move back.
Two main reasons. So we were struggling with the fact that I'd see kids around me over there and I'd see them as two split personalities, okay, of kids of Indian residents there. They'd be a very different kind of kid outside and a very different kind of kid inside. And both situations were very extreme. Like the kid inside was way more Indian than even an Indian kid in India.
Correct.
Because that's the pressure the parents would put on that kid. And the moment the kid steps outside, he has to mingle with everybody and he can't be the odd ball out. So, you know, these kids used to get all confused as to what are we? What is our identity? Is it something to be proud about? And I just felt that that's not fair to do to the child. And so I used to say to my wife at that time that, you know, let's make up our minds. Either we leave our kids here and grow them up here and then let them be like American kids and not force Indian values on them.
Yeah.
Or if we can't deal with that, which ultimately we couldn't, you know, then let's just pack our bags and go to India and let them grow in India. But let's not confuse the child in their early stages. So that's the call we took. And we came to India when my son was 1.5 years and my daughter was 7 months. So they knew nothing better, right? So for them, home was India. In fact, I was one of the strange animals where my parents were still in the US. But they were living in Chicago working. And I was in Dallas with Citibank. And we moved back. And my parents were in the US and I was sitting in India. So it was a reverse NRI situation. But that was the second reason that I wanted to build a base in India for my parents to come back to. Because they always wanted to come back and retire. So those are the two main reasons for us.
And then after that, you moved into, you know, you obviously moved into so many different roles, which have nothing to do with one another.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, from consulting to banking, and then you went into search. I mean, I remember you as one of the early CEOs of Confair.
Right.
And you, I think, virtually set up the entire concept of search firms in India.
Correct.
How does that work?
So, you know, when I first joined Confair, I mean, it was a long story how I even joined Confair, but we'll save that for another time. But once I did join Confair, one of the things I requested them was that give me 2 or 3 months to just figure out where I've landed. Okay, I want to understand the industry. I want to figure out what's making it work in other parts of the world. I want to figure out what's going on in India. I want to figure out what's happening with competition. And then I'd like to put a strategy together and move forward. Mm-hmm. So they allowed me that time. And so the existing CEO continued for 2-3 extra months before I took over. And it was all about evangelizing the whole concept of retained search. And I think a lot of the learnings from Citibank really, really helped me. Because these guys were far behind in terms of their maturity on what's a target market, how do you go about defining a target market, how do you work with them, what is it that you need to do with them, how do you displace competition, you know. So I put in some very basic things that I learned at Citi and created that kind of a scenario for all the people in the firm to change the culture and hired some really, really good professionals. And that was, again, a challenge. Attracting good talent to search in those days was a big challenge. But then I used my own personal example with everybody. I said, guys, look at me, look at my background. If I could do it, there's obviously some sense in doing this. Help me explain that to you. So I attracted some really good talent into the firm. We were the first firm to, in India, hire such good people from industry. And that really helped us propel ourselves forward. Mm-hmm. And then there was no looking back. I mean, we managed to, in my duration that I was there, we had a 60% CAGR on revenue. And 50% CAGR on revenue per search. And we ended up with a 53% margin, which was the highest margin that Confair had in any office in the world. And I got the chairman's trophy for that and all that. So it was a great experience to go from number 19, 20 in the country to number one. Of course, it took us a long time to get there with some of the big competitors well entrenched. But we managed to get there with about 5-6 years more of my reaping and enjoying that period before I finally left.
Fantastic. And at some stage, you know, over the years, the term headhunter, as it used to be then, transitioned to a search firm.
Right.
Headhunter, somehow, I used to joke about it in my time, it seems very cannibalistic.
Correct.
How many heads are you going to hunt?
Yeah.
But how did this transition happen? When?
So I think colloquially, even today, people are called headhunters.
Really? Okay.
Okay, in a colloquial sense.
Okay.
But in the real sense, I think it was all about professionalizing what we were doing.
Correct.
It was all about moving away from that Joe Blow down the road who would bring you anything you wanted and charge you a small fee after he placed the guy, to professionalizing it to a point where you could justify a retained fee.
Correct.
By saying, hey guys, you know, you got to pay us money beforehand.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're going to charge 1/3 of the first year's compensation. Now, to get to that stage, it was all about just professionalizing the whole thing. The right people going, you know, having the right sort of mindset, having the right thought processes, you know, being more, you know, sort of consultative in your approach, understanding the industry, understanding the challenges of the client. You know, I remember one of the early days I was sitting with a promoter, and the promoter had just finished spending 4 crores on a McKinsey study. And he had all these binders sitting above his office, in, above his seat. And I just said to him, I said, I don't want to take names, but I just said to him, I said, you know, you spent 4 crores on these on this McKinsey study, but do you have the people who can actually execute what is written in those binders?
Yeah.
And can your current team actually take you there to achieve the strategy that is being laid out over there? And that's the consultative kind of questioning that started making these people feel that we're professionals, mm-hmm. and we're like consultants, and they can actually work with us in a consulting manner.
True.
And we started commanding respect, and we therefore started commanding a fee, and it just moved from there.
Yeah, and you probably changed the mindset of so many industrialists.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, because
they were used to a 15% or 12% fee contingent if the guy is placed.
Yeah.
To suddenly moving away to a situation where, you know, cut the first check before
Correct.
You even
Correct.
Get 5 minutes of your time.
So two questions on the search firm space from the perspective of all our people who listen to us. If I'm a young 30, 32, 33 year old senior manager or middle management person, at what stage do I start to seek out getting attention from a search firm?
So from a middle management level upwards for the big search firms, I mean, there's always search firms for the level you're at.
Absolutely.
But for the big five search firms, you know, from the mid-management level upwards, and, you know, start doing things to attract their attention, right? Otherwise, you're just anybody else.
So question, how do you attract attention?
So obviously by being, you know, a superb performer in your field. I mean, that's a given, right? But secondly, many times a superb performer in his field remains under the carpet, dormant, quiet. So you need to come out, right? And let, you know, you need to be in the media, you need to write articles, you need to be, you know, sort of read about, somebody needs to appreciate you somewhere. So somewhere you need to be in some sort of limelight. Doesn't have to be major limelight, but some sort of limelight, so that search firms sit up and say, hey, you know, in this field, in this area, this guy is one of the tops, okay? And we need to make a list of these guys. So somewhere you need to bring that out. And that's usually in a, you know, multinational, you get those opportunities to be able to get to be seen by the market through media or whatever. But some of the smaller Indian companies, sometimes that gets buried, right? The promoter takes all the thunder.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to step out and professionally come out in media and stuff yourself through your own contributory articles and all that. And just, you know, get known in the market, and automatically, and if you make one or two moves in your career, I think that's also helpful, because people then get to know you. Otherwise, if you stay at the same firm for, you know, 30 years, chances are no one knows you.
Yeah. Or even if they do know you, they say this
person guy not gonna move.
No, that's a fascinating answer. So, a lot of people will be looking at it. So now, moving to the next part of our chat, one more avatar that you have is as an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And you say that by 2030 there'll be about 100 million people over 60. What is your vision for your venture?
So two things, you know, I always had a dream to do something in the alternate medicine space. And then I took a year after.
Is it because of your original
healthcare,
love for health?
I love healthcare, and also my parents and me, we sat together one time. We said, you know, what is that we could be doing? What is the charitable piece we could be doing? And we agreed that I'll do something in the alternative medicine space, and we'll try and create a charitable component to that. So that was the old dream parked away from 20 years ago that I'll do at some stage after my retirement. So here was my chance to really start to think about doing something. And then I came across the whole senior citizen space, the senior living space, and I found a huge shortage there, and a huge where we are significantly behind the world in terms of where we are in India. This space today, it's about 100 million people in the age group of 16 above, 130 to be precise as we speak now, expected to move to 300, okay, in by 2050. And then if you look at the housing for these people, it's mostly old age homes. They aren't luxury spaces, barring a few that have come up now. And even in those, if you look at those old age homes, there's only about under 10,000 such facilities around the country. And the demand is for about 3 lakh, okay, as we sit today. And as the mindsets are changing of people, families are becoming more and more nuclear. With the kids being abroad, parents being by themselves, also a need for the desire for the parents to be independent, a desire for the kids to be independent. So I think there's going to be more and more of this as we move forward. So I just thought, why can't I marry these two things? Sure. And then I looked around the world, and there wasn't a single senior living facility anywhere in the world which had the concept of integrative medicine. Now that's one of our USPs, where we're bringing integrative medicine into it. Integrative medicine is a combination of allopathy with Ayurveda, naturopathy, Chinese medicine, homeopathy, all the fields of medicine combined together and in a scientific way being administered to you for your ailment.
Okay.
So no one under the pressure to try and cure all your ailments in one field, but say, okay, for this, maybe allopathy isn't right. Maybe it's naturopathy or maybe it's Chinese medicine. So to be able to do that in an integrative manner is what is becoming now a fairly well-accepted fact around the world. In fact, we now have institutes of integrative medicine in the US, in Canada. In India, we've got one of our first integrative medicine centers that's come up in Kochi called Namami. So the same guy who set that up is helping us with our integrative medicine that we are putting into the senior living facility that we are creating in there.
Fascinating. And what is the response of senior citizens on actually packing their bags and moving to a new location?
The response is good,
yeah,
in the sense that people are understanding the concept a lot. They are accepting the concept. Of course, there has to be some driver in their minds to move to Dehradun.
Yeah.
They're leaving wherever their home is. And sometimes it could be because because of the hills, because of cleaner air, because of the pristine nature all around you. Sometimes you're not so tied down to being in a big city, or sometimes saying, hey, let's gather a group of friends and go. So there are different motivators for people to do that. But in today's time, you can be anywhere. And my challenge to everyone is that why be in a polluted city? You needed to be here when you were working, but now you're not.
Correct.
So why can't you be in a place which can give you a longer life with cleaner air and a nicer environment, closer to nature? We have a business center, work from there, whatever work you're doing, whether it's advisory or the kinds of things you would be doing at this stage of your life. And it's going to be an international airport from next year, so fly in and out from there. So the acceptance level is good, but I think the mindset still in people's mind is, oh, I got to check with my kids, or my kids are saying no, or,
Yeah.
So I think the actual signing of a agreement to move is still a challenge. Mm-hmm. It's not happening slam dunk like I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still needing some work on it, and still going to take some time before we can get a real...
I guess it'll take a group of 2, 3, 4 couples
to start moving together.
Let's move together, so
correct,
we at least have
a
familiarity with some people.
Correct.
And then we start making new
correct
friends.
That's what's beginning to happen now.
Yeah. I agree. So one of the questions on a little more general about startups. You've seen startups, I'm sure. Like all of us, you've put money into startups, may have made money in some, may have lost money in. I've lost a lot of money on startups. What mistakes do startup entrepreneurs make? And now you are a startup entrepreneur yourself.
So a little bit about what I've seen in the market. I've also been a bit of an angel investor, and a little bit about my own experience. I'll combine the two and say that I think trying to go at an idea of yours all by yourself and thinking that you're the macho guy who can make it happen sometimes isn't right, because sometimes it's better to have a little bit more capability and some complementary skills that you bring together to make it happen. So that could be one.
So you're saying that one should try and get a partner?
One or two. I think it's always good to do that. It just increases the bandwidth, increases the capacity to make things happen. Mm-hmm. And then if it's complementary skills, then it's really a benefit, right? So that's one. I think two, try and have a market which is, have a product that's serving a market which is not a niche, okay? And I'm speaking again from my own experience, right? We are trying to serve a sleeve of the market, which is a niche. And sometimes to capture that niche is not easy. Okay, even though your product might be great, but the takers are so few that to be able to get a lion market share, of that small sleeve that you're trying to address is a challenge.
Sure.
Okay, so that I think is something that people should think through, that is my product a little bit more broad-based in terms of its need, or is it very small in terms of the sleeve that I'm trying to serve? So that could be a second one to think through carefully. And really the third one, again, it's related to the second one, is, define your target market, carefully, and define your marketing strategies and all around that target market very carefully. And have your business plan and all put together sensibly to cover that, and have your finances lined up. That's another challenge. Sometimes you feel, okay, I've got X amount of money. With that, I'll make it happen. Y will come from here. D, Z will come from there. And you haven't thought through it in too much detail, and then you run yourself into a situation where A and Y isn't coming and Z isn't coming either. So then you're kind of stuck with your own funds.
Money is so critical.
Yeah, and so that's again another thing that I find has gone wrong with startups.
So let me pivot to second innings.
Mm-hmm.
I've often said that, and you're younger than me, but I've often said that most of us will probably have a life of 30 odd years after 60. Which is almost going to be equal to your working life.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people I know struggle to be able to handle life after 60.
Yeah.
And I think you are busier than ever.
Yeah.
Right? What are some of the things that you did in your working life that started to help you to plan post-superannuation, if I can use that term?
I think in my specific case, having a dream and having a passion to go after that dream was something that really propelled me forward without giving it too much of thought as to what I want to do and where I want to do. I was very clear that this is what I want to do at some stage. So it was a dream and a passion that helped me. But in a lot of situations that I look around, I think people jump into a lot of situations just following what other people are doing. And I think it's important to spend some time figuring out, there's nothing wrong in just, even enjoying life.
Sure.
And doing some of the things that you, pursuing some of your hobbies or sports or whatever that you didn't end up doing during your working life. So while one can do advisory, one can do teaching, one can do, startups, one can start a venture like I have. But it's also nothing wrong in just pursuing hobbies and being with family and traveling around the world and doing fun things, because it's not easy to start another business. Being an advisory, teaching is still okay.
Yeah.
But starting up another business like I have, there are many days when I wake up and say, what was the need for me to do this? Okay. Okay. I mean, why did I do this? Of course, for me, it was a passion and a dream that I was chasing.
Yeah.
So it's still okay to chase it, and I will continue to do so.
Mm.
But yeah, I think it's important to give that a good thought. I mean, I have a friend who's got a hobby of wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
So all he does is go from one life sanctuary to another wildlife sanctuary.
Yes.
And doing photography, and he's, you know, spending the time making albums, making movies, making slides, and showing it to people. I mean, he spends all his time doing that. Nothing wrong with it.
Absolutely.
So I think people should. There isn't any right or wrong. I think it's don't be under pressure to do what everyone else is doing,
mm-hmm.
and really ask yourself, you know, what is it that would excite me, and do that.
Yep.
Do what excites you.
And yet, it's important to have something to do.
You must have something to do. Otherwise, you'll go nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, so you got to have something to do. I mean, 60 is, today is 40.
Yeah.
So you still actually have a lot of active years. You have a lot of energy in
yeah.
you. And you've got to deploy it, you know, whether it's in social work or, in, you know, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
But you've got to deploy that energy somewhere.
Correct. So now moving to the last segment, a few questions on you personally. You had a fantastic career. Now, I'm sure your entrepreneurial venture will be a big success. What is the secret of your success?
I think always having a dream and a passion to run after it is something that happened in my case, always. Having the belief that you can get to where you want to get to, you know, having the belief that the vision is achievable, and more importantly, having the belief that you can do it. You know, just keeping those things in place have worked for me. And I've always taken on challenges. I've always got into situations which I wasn't familiar with. And just kept the belief and the vision going and applied simple logic without complicating things. And it's worked for me. Whether it worked for everyone, I don't know, but it certainly worked for me.
Interesting. When was the last time you did something for the first time?
Geez, everything I've done is for the first time. The last time I did something for the first time is getting into the senior living space, I would say, and daily living that first time of experiencing going and selling to an individual. A senior living space which he may or may not be ready for. I've never sold to an individual, I've always sold to corporates. So it's been a B2B kind of life, and now suddenly I've moved to a B2C situation. So each day is a first time for me in a lot of ways.
Fascinating. And Deepak, my last question to you is, what would be your biggest learning from your failures or your biggest failures?
I think acceptance that it's happened, not what you wanted, but it's happened. So firstly, accept it with some humility. And then immediately moving to a situation of not trying to defend what happened, but really trying to understand what went wrong. What can I learn from it? How can I amend things moving forward? And how can I not repeat that mistake? I think to me, those are critical.
Fantastic. Deepak, thank you very much for being on our podcast.
Thank you.
I think everything you've said is very valuable to all our listeners and viewers.
Hope so.
Grateful
thank you.
That you came here.
Thank you
thank
so
you.
Much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for the Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.